What they do is take exercise pills. Each pill provides the equivalent of 1 hour of, quoted in Brownell, UFOs, Key to Earth's Destiny. Vigorous exercise. It is taken along with a pep pill, to counter the fatigue it brings on. Gee, do the space people all speak the same language? Humans throughout the universe speak many languages. They are able to communicate, however, via a lingua franca, an ancient tongue known as Solex Mal. According to George Hunt Williamson, In Other Tongues, Other Flesh, Amherst Press, 1958, Solex Mal was once the universal language of man. This was millions of years ago, an era we dimly recall as the Golden Age. All human languages, terrestrial and extraterrestrial alike, derive from Solex Mal, says Williamson. And the terrestrial language least divergent from it is that of the Ainu, the aboriginal inhabitants of Japan. If he's right, the myths and legends of the Ainu should be examined, for what could be our clearest recollection of that golden age? Do the space people have pleasant voices? They do indeed. Orthon, says Adamski, had music in his voice. And remember Hope Droxel's account of that spaceman floating along a path. She goes on to describe how they drew closer and closer, he gliding above the ground, she quivering with anticipation. Finally they met. As he passed me on the path, Droxel reports, he spoke in the most melodious voice, saying like a chord of music, "Hello." Seconds later, she turned about for another look at this malevolent being. And he was gone. Gee, will my wristwatch keep running aboard the saucer, or does time cease to exist? Time will continue to flow, but your watch could get magnetized. Stay away from the propulsion system. Your watch will be confusing, of course, during any stopover on a planet. Venus, for example, has that 17-hour day. Try to borrow a local clock. Gee, should I bring a flashlight? You won't need one. During your stay aboard the saucer, you'll glow in the dark. Are the laundry facilities aboard? The space people's jumpsuit is made of a self-cleaning fabric. They simply empty a bucket of soapy water on themselves, and the suit goes through a rapid cycle of wash, spin, and dry, so they don't have washing machines. But here's what you can do: open a porthole, and toss your laundry into space. Reshirt it quickly, or the air will rush out, your clothes will float about out there, absorbing cosmic energy and loose hydrogen. Come back in an hour, and they'll be clean. Can I smoke aboard the saucer? Sure, if you don't mind being tractor-beamed back to Earth, immediately and unceremoniously. Neither the space people nor the space aliens tolerate smoking aboard their ships. Firkin and his friends are committed to a healthful, holistic lifestyle, while the aliens, with their insurance scam, are careful to enforce a federal regulation that bans smoking in medical facilities. So don't even think about smoking on a saucer. And remember, they can read your mind. If you must smoke, go outside, you can survive in space for up to a minute. Gee, are you a certified professor? The title of professor is often acquired, in an informal fashion, by those professing knowledge, skill, or competence in some popular art or science. Our ranks have included conjurers, dancing masters, auctioneers, banjo players, jugglers, phrenologists, dowsers, band leaders, and trainers of performing fleas. And while none of us have been certified, all have sought to contribute their expertise to the public weal, in an accomplished and responsible manner. Gee, should I report my flying saucer experience to the authorities when I get back? Why bother? You'll be either ignored or labeled a kook. Instead, get in touch with one of the grassroots UFO organizations, etc., and tell them what happened. Their address can be found at your local library. Gee, I want to believe that George Adamski had those encounters with the space people. But isn't it improbable that extraterrestrials would look just like us? Not at all. Luzinstag quotes Adamski as explaining, "The human model is very suitable for its purpose. Why shouldn't it be current also on other planets under similar conditions?" Many scientists have come to agree with him. Gee, did Adamski ever meet with the space aliens? No, but he knew about them, and tried to warn us. In 1960, according to Zinsdag, Adamski began to talk about a new and strange type of extraterrestrial. This species was visiting us, he believed, with some nefarious purpose. Librarians are trained to view you as a patron, not a cook. During my research for this book, I found them to be invariably helpful and friendly. If abducted, what can I expect in the way of an examination table, comfortable or uncomfortable? An abductee told Dr. Mack that the table was extremely comfortable, molding itself to the contours of his body. It will be cold, though, so insist upon a gown. Gee, as an abductee, might I be billed for my medical exam? If so, will my insurance cover it? The aliens can usually get the government to pay. If not, they'll bill your private insurer. Check that you're covered while traveling out of state. Gee, are the space aliens who perform the medical exams really doctors? Not as the term is generally understood. They are technicians, trained in the operation of diagnostic and therapeutic devices. What is lacking is any rapport with a human being on their table, or any sense of the art of healing. If these things are important to you, see a doctor, not an alien. Gee, if I'm abducted, are dental exams also available? Only over certain Western states. Gee, do the space aliens ever return an abductee to the wrong house, to somebody else's bed? It has happened on occasion. The house was located on the same street and was similar in appearance to that of the abductee. Should you find yourself in this awkward situation, simply apologize to your neighbor and explain what happened. Is it true that space aliens have disguised themselves and infiltrated human society? Apparently so. In what numbers we don't know, as they are indistinguishable from ordinary citizens. Gee, has a Tibetan monk ever traveled to Venus aboard a flying saucer? As a matter of fact, yes. T. Lobsang Rampa, best-selling author of books on Tibetan mysticism, describes his experience in My Visit to Venus, Sorcerian Press, 1966. Rampa's status as a Tibetan monk has been questioned. After the success of his first book, he was accused of being a journalist named Cyril Hoskin, who had never been outside of England. The author admitted the charge, but with an explanation. He had fallen from a ladder, he said, and suffered a concussion, whereupon his body had been vacated by the Englishman and taken over by the wandering soul of the Tibetan. My barber claims that a UFO abducted an entire herd of elephants from a safari park. Did this really happen? Yes, it did, according to a story in the July 26, 1988 issue of the Weekly World News. The pilfered pachydermes were struck by an orange ray and sucked into the belly of a hovering starship. Witnesses were said to be speechless. The reason for the abduction remains a mystery. Perhaps the space aliens are experimenting with that memory block of theirs, on the terrestrial creature most renowned for its memory. Why are flying saucers constantly being sighted in the vicinity of Mount Shasta? The phenomenon has yet to be explained. A possible answer involves those ancient Mayans, see page 22. Another, suggested by Adamski, is that Mount Shasta is a remnant of ancient Lemuria. Having retained the vibes of that mysterious civilization, it attracts UFOs. Still another is that entities from another dimension are drawn to this sacred place. Mount Shasta is sacred to local Indians, or it may be that a certain refreshment stand, located at the foot of the mountain and famous for its chili dogs, has been attracting even the space people. Though vegetarians, space people are permitted to deviate from their diet for purposes of research into a planet's culinary customs. I know that extraterrestrial craft can be fairly large, up to a mile long, in the case of mother ships. My question is, how small do they get? In 1965, a small disc, about 1.5 meters in diameter, landed near an old fortress in Cuzco, Peru. Two diminutive creatures, say witnesses, emerged from the disc, but upon realizing they had been detected, they scampered back inside and flew off. And an even smaller craft was photographed recently, hovering over a breakfast table. Gee, is space a vacuum or does it have air? Contrary to scientific opinion, space contains a significant amount of air. In a letter to a student, George Adamski reveals that certain species of bird migrate from planet to planet, proof of the existence of an atmosphere and space. G. Do flying saucers pollute a planet's atmosphere? Absolutely not. The space people are concerned for the environment, both their own and that of the planets they visit. They were recently awarded a Pleiades Prize for their method of trash disposal. What they do is launch all non-recyclable material towards a black hole. Drawn into the hole, it disappears into another universe. Gee, many of the flying saucers in photographs look like pie plates to me. In other words, they're fake. Is this possible? Actually, it could be the other way around. Pie plates may resemble flying saucers, having been modeled on them. Pies were first baked during the Middle Ages, an era no stranger to prodigies in the sky. Bakers, the theory goes, shaped their plates to represent those prodigies. The tradition is still with us. In Houston, a bakery called the Flying Saucer Pie Company has explicitly modeled its product on UFOs. A friend of mine is currently aboard a flying saucer. I'd like to mail her a letter. Can that be done? Yes. A number of special boxes are maintained by the space people for the posting of such letters. Their locations are Mount Shasta, Stonehenge, the Great Pyramid, Graceland. Pickups are daily. No stamp is required. G. How do you say flying saucer in some languages other than English? Soucoupe volante, French, flagend unterdussen, girl. Incidentally, you might be able to reach her by telephone. After a trip to Jupiter, Standing Horse telephoned his wife from the control room of the saucer and told her he'd be back around 8 o'clock that night. Man, Bludza, Russian, Disci Volanti, Italian, Farfuriais Birua, Romanian, Fadia, Chinese. Gee, why do flying saucers land? To make repairs, gather geological or biological samples, pick up supplies, sugar, MJB coffee, attend poetry readings, create crop circles, or take aboard a contactee. While on the ground, they sometimes masquerade as a barn, restaurant, or other type of building. The donut shop shown below is an example of such mimicry. A vacationing family were driving one night near Crater Lake in Oregon, when, according to a report on file with the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, they rounded a bend and came upon a restaurant, a large, circular building that was brightly lit up. They parked their car and went in. Seating themselves at an oddly shaped table, they ordered dinner. The waitress who served them, identical in appearance to the other waitresses, was short, blonde, and clad in a silver uniform. She had a musical voice. Eating, paying, and piling back into their car, the family drove on. At a crossroads, they mentioned the restaurant to a highway worker, who looked at them as if they were nuts or something and insisted no such place existed. Then one of the daughters discovered she had left her purse at the table. They drove back. But the restaurant was gone. What are crop circles? Crop circles, or agroglyphs, are mysterious symbols that have been found etched in fields, mostly in England. They are believed to be messages left behind by UFOs. Gee, if you could offer one piece of advice to someone about to take a ride in a flying saucer, what would it be? Maintain a positive frame of mind. As the Del Perse book on UFOs, which fits nicely in an encounter kit, by the way, recommends, from a psychological vantage point, it seems that anyone finding himself or herself involved in a UFO encounter would be well advised to maintain a positive mental attitude in order to bring out the highest and best potentials of the confrontation. G. has photographed the surface of Venus, yet no sign of any Venusian civilization. What gives, Professor? The Venusians and their cities exist at a higher rate of F. Richard Knoll, UFO Encounters, Del, 1978. Vibration than we do. Thus, they are invisible to us, under normal circumstances. So if you want a glimpse of them, you'll have to raise your vibration rate. The easiest way to do that is to take your telescope to an amusement park. Locate a relaxolator, one of those coin-operated vibration machines, and stand on it while viewing Venus. As the true features of the planet reveal themselves, you'll feel like a regular Galileo. 7. This and That. The Mars Restaurant on a busy street in a Midwestern city is a luncheonette called the Mars Restaurant. The name is proclaimed on a sign that hangs over the sidewalk. On several occasions I had driven past this restaurant and wondered, why the name Mars? A whimsical choice? Or had somebody traveled to Mars and opened a restaurant upon his return? See suggestion in making the most, my curiosity was piqued. So I decided to pay a visit. Accompanied by a photographer, I drove to the Mars restaurant. We parked across the street and approached the place. I was reading the sign in the window, $1.85, when a customer emerged and urged us to go in. The breakfasts were great. Try the gyro omelette, he said. We entered and sat at the counter. A youthful waitress took our order, coffee and donuts. I looked around. The restaurant had been remodeled at some point, but had since sunk into a mild decrepitude. No outer space decor was evident. In fact, the Mars restaurant had no decor at all, just booths, stools, and counter. The waitress returned with coffee and a single donut, the only one left. We split it. The photographer bantered with the waitress. Her name was Anna, we learned, and she was from the neighborhood. I asked how the restaurant had gotten its name. Anna had no idea. Ask the owner, she said. She pointed out a man who was going back and forth between kitchen and counter. He was wearing an apron. Alas, no silver jumpsuit. I went back and asked him why it was called the Mars Restaurant. His name, he replied, with a Greek accent. Yes, I persisted, but why that particular name? What was the significance? He shrugged and said he didn't know. He had bought the place a year and a half ago, and the name had come with it. I returned to my stool. We finished our coffee and left. Out on the sidewalk I pondered what we had learned, or failed to learn. I was puzzled. How had this luncheonette come to be named after the planet, or the god, Mars? Nobody seemed to know. It was a mystery, I realized. Heaven and earth abound in mysteries. And here was one of them. Women in flying saucers. Most of the luminaries of the UFO scene have been male. Yet almost from the start, women have played a significant role in our relations with extraterrestrials. As both contactees and ufologists, they have made an enormous contribution to our understanding of those with whom we share the universe, while as pilots of the saucers, they have helped to guide us towards a saner future. Women have also brought to the study of UFOs their unique perspective, a point of view at once intuitive and intellectual, down to earth and metaphysical. The following is a brief survey of their accomplishments. Pilots. Jean Dixon, the tabloid Seer, insists that many saucers are piloted by women. The testimony of contactees would seem to confirm this. Truman Bethlehem has told us of Aura Raines, captain of the ship from Clarion. While Standing Horse has described his encounter with Mondrowlika. Contactee Sonia Lyubin was an Australian who went to Saturn in a flying saucer. Accompanying her was Adamski's friend Orthon. Lyubin later traveled to the U.S. by conventional means, and spent 6 months with Adamski. Elizabeth Clara Fielding, a South African, was given a ride in a UFO. It was manned, she reports in Beyond the Light Barrier. Timmons, 1980, by two elderly men in jumpsuits. Helen Mitchell, taken by saucer to a mother ship, was urged to speak out against atomic bombs, which she does in We Met the Space People, Saucerian Press, 1967. And Hope Droxall was founder of the School of Thought, and president of the Church of Cosmic Origin. She was in communication with Mohada of the Galaxies, an 11th dimensional being. Ufologists. Coral Lorenzen was founder of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, a major investigatory group, and author of numerous books and articles. Margaret Sachs edited the UFO Encyclopedia. But the most notable woman in ufology was Laura Mundo. Her involvement with flying saucers spanned 3 decades, and is worth looking at in detail. Mundo in 1953. Laura Mundo was a housewife, living in a suburb of Detroit, raising two teenagers. She did some acting on a local television show, but that was the extent of excitement or challenge in her life. All that changed with the publication of George Adamski's Flying Saucers Have Landed. Mundo avidly read the book, as did several of her friends. Enthralled by his tale, they decided to invite Adamski to come deliver a lecture in Detroit. Mundo, with her experience in television, offered to handle publicity for the event. Adamski accepted the invitation, took a train to Detroit, and delivered his lecture to a sellout crowd. 4,500 people came to the Masonic Temple to hear the lowdown on flying saucers, from a contactee, and Adamski, with his slideshow, anecdotes, and sly charm did not disappoint them. When Mundo got home that evening, her phone was ringing. Someone wanted information on UFOs. She gave it to them, and was soon taking another call, and another. As publicist for the lecture, she had been thrust into the role of information provider. It was the beginning of an involvement with flying saucers that would become for Laura Mundo a consuming passion. That involvement manifested itself in several ways. To begin with, she became a booking agent for lecturers. Mundo sought out further speaking engagements for Adamski, and set up a tour for co-author Desmond Leslie, whom she describes in the Mundo UFO report as tall, handsome, suave. Quite a contrast to Adamski, who was uneducated, used bad grammar, with a heavy foreign accent. Gruff. As the saucer craze grew, she brought to Detroit other contactee lecturers, Buck Nelson, Truman Bethurum, Howard Menger. Her own home, meanwhile, had become a UFO clubhouse. Her living room served as a meeting place for enthusiasts, who would show up unannounced at her door. Shelves brimmed with UFO literature. On the wall was a bulletin board for reports of sightings, and Adamski's spectacular photo of a saucer. The phone was constantly ringing, as newspapers referred queries to what Mundo was now calling the Planetary Space Center. The name was later changed to the Interplanetary Center, then to the Flying Saucer Information Center. Mail poured in from everywhere. Her home had become what was probably the first clearinghouse for UFO information. She and her friends were doing the job that the Air Force should have been doing, said Mundo, but that had fallen by default to dedicated civilians like themselves. One of the main activities of the center was the publication of a newsletter. Known successively as Saucer Tidbits, the Open Letter, Emergency Press, the Mundo Monitor, and the Interplanetary News, it was sent free to anyone interested in flying saucers, and exchanged for other newsletters. The newsletter is still being published, under the name Update! Exclamation mark by one of her former associates. Thus, Mundo promoted communication between individuals and groups who were interested in UFOs. In her book The Mundo UFO Report, she describes the purpose of the center. We are not organized to prove or disprove your sighting. Only to bring together those who want an opportunity to discuss what is happening, if only for psychological release. In addition to the newsletter, Mundo was producing pamphlets and books. The pamphlets, mimeographed in her basement, bore such titles as Sex and the UFO and How to Contact a Space Person. Her books included Flying Saucers and The Father's Plan, Sorcerian Press, 1956, Earth Woman, Interplanetary Center, 1967, and The Mundo UFO Report, Vantage Press, 1982. Her writing is interesting, if at times unreadable, with the abbreviated ellipses are a stylistic quirk of Mundo's. Vantage Press is a subsidy, or vanity, house. Mundo had parted ways early on with Sorcerian, the leading UFO press. She complained that Gray Barker, its proprietor, had not proofread her manuscript, nor shared the profits with her. She may also have been offended by his condescending reference to her as my favorite ufology gal. A curious mix of UFO gossip and abstruse metaphysics. She is an excellent source on George Adamski. A major theme in her work is that the space people have come to save us from accelerating sunspots, a solar condition that will cause earthquakes, storms, and madness, and from ourselves. The space people are already living among us, ready to help inaugurate a utopian way of life. Some of the pamphlets were transcripts of lectures that Mundo herself was now delivering. Her audiences were UFO clubs, civic and church groups, and even schools, in Detroit and elsewhere. It was the 50s, and interest in UFOs was widespread. While not entirely respectable, they were a sensationalistic novelty that had captured the public's imagination. By the end of the decade, the novelty had faded, and interest in flying saucers had waned. But not for Mundo. For her, they remained a consuming passion, and something more. They had become a cause. While recovering from a heart attack during the early 70s, she told a reporter, "My work must continue. I have a mission here on Earth. Everything else was secondary to that mission." As the work came more and more fully into my life, she says in Flying Saucers, "I gave up my television work and slowly sold my possessions until my sons, and others, who would want no credit, have extended me patronage in order to continue to write full-time." The work was not without its indignities, hazards, and frustrations. Mundo describes being laughed out of newspaper offices and television studios. On one occasion, her house was stoned. There were malicious letters and phone calls. And government officials ignored her attempts to alert them to the UFO situation. An exception was Jimmy Carter, who, as mentioned earlier, had had a sighting of his own. He passed her letter on to an Air Force colonel, who responded, "On behalf of President Carter, I am replying to your recent letter concerning unidentified flying objects, UFOs, and wish to thank you for sharing with him your views and comments. Your concern and support during this trying period are greatly appreciated. Thank you for taking the time to write." Letter quoted in the Mundo UFO report. Mundo's writings were those of a ufologist, not a contactee. She never claimed to have ridden in a spaceship, nor to have communicated with its occupants. Yet she did have experiences that confirmed her belief in the existence and significance of flying saucers. One of these came at the beginning of her ufological career. Just before Adamski's first visit to Detroit, she was awoken during the night by the ceiling lamp. A burnt-out bulb had come on. From over the house she could hear a humming sound. A flying saucer. Its energy flowed through her, and for a brief moment she felt ecstatic, raised to the prime atomic state. And some months later she saw her first flying saucer, a bell-shaped Adamski model, passing over the house. But her most memorable experience was a meeting with Orthon. In March of 1956 she arrived at a restaurant in Detroit, to dine with attendees of a UFO convention. Among those present was a tall, blonde-haired man, garbed in a zoot suit that seemed to glow. She instantly sensed him to be Orthon, the Venusian with whom Adamski had chatted in the desert. Orthon kept smiling at Mundo the entire evening, and as he left the restaurant, he paused beside her and gazed deeply into her eyes. Mundo continued to spot the occasional spaceman, and to expand her information network. But at the center of her ufological universe remained the man who had introduced her to flying saucers, their chief prophet, George Adamski. She never flagged in her admiration for Adamski, and worked with him, or kept in touch, until his death. On a number of occasions he came back to Detroit to lecture. Despite revelations about his character, Mundo remained a devoted acolyte. Those revelations began as early as 1954, when she traveled to California and visited Adamski. One night he and his wife Mary took her to a restaurant. When Adamski left the table for a moment, Mary leaned over to Mundo and whispered a warning. Her husband was not a good man, she said, and Mundo should avoid having anything further to do with him. Also, tales of his sexual shenanigans had begun to circulate. In Sex and the UFO, Mundo reports that at Palomar Gardens Adamski's women followers were offering themselves to the spaceman present and Adamski taking what was left over, and there were rumors of the prophet having confided that he was in it for the money. Mundo accepted that some of this might be true. But she still believed in him, rationalizing that Adamski had been selected by the space people for the force of both his negative and positive energies. The reports of his lustiness had come as no surprise to Mundo.